wherever he goes. When away from home, Bert boasts, he'd put his hawk on a velvet stool in a dining chamber or parlour, as the place was whereunto I went, for I would have my hawk as much in my eye as could be. Perhaps I should see the lady or mistress of the house look discontentedly thereat, he deadpans. But so well have I been acquainted with my hawk's good disposition, that I have promised, if my hawk should make a mute in that room, I would lick it up with my tongue. Edmund Burt haunted White as he trained his hawk, just as White haunted me, but it was a different kind of haunting. I had a sort of schoolgirlish pash for that serious old man who lived 300 years ago, he privately confessed. He wanted to impress Burt. He was in love with him. Dizzied by medievalist imaginings, in love with a falconer 300 years dead, he had decided to ignore the teachings of Blaine, for the most part, and train his hawk the old-fashioned way. The old hawk masters had invented a means of taming them which offered no visible cruelty, and whose secret cruelty had to be borne by the trainer as well as by the bird. They kept the bird awake, not by nudging it or by any mechanical means, but by walking about with their pupil on their fist and staying awake themselves. The hawk was watched, was deprived of sleep by a sleepless man for a space of 2, 3, or as much as 9 nights together. White willfully misunderstood Burt's methods. The 17th century Ostringer would have had any number of friends and attendants to take over while he slept, but White was desirous of a rite of passage, a proper night's vigil, and he needed to do it alone, man against man, as it were. Watching his hawk would be a privation, an ordeal, a test of his word. He would not be cruel, but he would conquer both the hawk and himself in one fell swoop. Man against bird, he wrote, with God as an umpire. They had sat each other out for 3,000 years. In this long vigil, White had 6 hours sleep in 6 days, the effects of extreme tiredness took their toll. Again and again, delirious from lack of sleep, sitting in the kitchen or standing in the lamplit barn, he lifted the fat and frightened hawk onto his fist, reciting it passages from Hamlet, Macbeth, Richard II, Othello. But the tragedy had to be kept out of the voice, and all the sonnets he could remember, whistling hymns to it, playing at Gilbert and Sullivan, an Italian opera, and deciding on reflection that hawks like Shakespeare best. When I was a student, I took a paper on tragedy as part of my English degree. This was not without irony, for I was comprehensively tragic. I wore black, smoked filterless camels, skulked about the place with coal-caked eyes, and failed to write a single essay about Greek tragedy, Jacobean tragedy, Shakespearean tragedy, or indeed do much at all. "I'd like to write Miss MacDonald a glowing report," one of my supervisors noted dryly. "But as I've never seen her and I've no idea what she looks like, this I cannot do." But I read all the same. I read a lot. And I found there were myriad definitions of this thing called tragedy that had wormed its way through the history of literature. And the simplest of all was this, that it is the story of a figure who, through some moral flaw or personal failing, falls through force of circumstance to his doom. It was the tragedy paper that led me to read Freud, because he was still fashionable back then, and because psychoanalysts had their shot at explaining tragedy too. And after reading him, I began to see all sorts of psychological transferences in my falconry books. I saw those 19th century falconers were projecting onto their hawks all the male qualities they thought threatened by modern life: wildness, power, virility, independence, and strength. By identifying with their hawks as they trained them, they could introject or repossess those qualities. At the same time, they could exercise their power by civilizing a wild and primitive creature. Masculinity and conquest, two imperial myths for the price of one. The Victorian falconer assumed the power and strength of the hawk, and the hawk assumed the manners of the man. For White, too, falconry involved strange projections, but of very different qualities. His young German goshawk was a living expression of all the dark, discreditable desires within himself he tried to repress for years. It was a thing fey, fairy, feral, ferocious, and cruel. He had tried for so long to be a gentleman, tried to fit in, to adhere to all the rules of civilized society, to be normal, to be like everyone else. But his years at Stowe, and his analysis and the fear of war, had brought him to breaking point. He had refused humanity in favor of Hawks, but he could not escape himself. Once again, White was engaged in a battle to civilize the perversity and unruliness within himself. Only now, he had put those things in the Hawk, and he was trying to civilize them there. He found himself in a strange, locked battle with a bird that was all the things he longed for, but had always fought against. It was a terrible paradox, a proper tragedy. No wonder living with Goss brought him nearly to madness. He is lost. The barn is a dungeon. He is swimmingly, drunkenly tired. A chill summer wind blows through the walls. White owls hunt outside, powdery, reed-thin shrieks under a low orange moon. He is an executioner, he thinks, and he should be wearing a mask, a black one that conceals his face. He has been measuring time in the baits of the hawk, in the hundreds of times he's lifted the screaming captive back onto the glove. The barn is the Bastille. The hawk is a prisoner. The falconer is a man in riding breeches and a checked coat. He stands in a Rembrandt interior. A pile of sticks and empty jars on the brick floor. Cobwebs on the walls. A broken grate. A barrel of flowers beer. A pool of light from the oil lamp. And the hawk. The hawk. The hawk. The hawk. It is on his fist. All the sepia arrowheads on its pale breast disheveled and frayed from his hands. The man is swaying backwards and forwards like a man on a ship, as if the ground beneath him pitched and rolled like the sea. He is trying to stay awake. He is trying to keep the hawk awake. The hawk is trying to close its eyes and sleep, but the swaying pulls it back. I am free, the man is telling himself. Free. He stares at the cobwebs behind the exhausted hawk. I am in Perda, he thinks happily. I must not look the hawk in the eye. I must not punish the hawk, though it baits and beats, and my hand is raw with pecks, and my face stings from the blows of its baiting wings. Hawks cannot be punished. They would rather die than submit. Patience is my only weapon. Patience, derived from patior, meaning to suffer. It is an ordeal. I shall triumph. He sways on his feet and suffers, and the hawk suffers too. The owls are silent now. They quarter the ridings over turf drenched with dew. Chapter 9. The Rite of Passage. The feathers down her front are the colour of sunned newsprint of tea-stained paper, and each is marked darkly towards its tip with a leaf-bladed spearhead, so from her throat to her feet she is patterned with a shower of falling raindrops. Her wings are the colour of stained oak, their covert feathers edged in palest teak, barred flight feathers folded quietly beneath. And there's a strange grey tint to her that is felt rather than seen, a kind of silvery light, like a rainy sky reflected from the surface of a river. She looks new, looks as if the world cannot touch her, as if everything that exists and is observed rolls off like drops of water from her oiled and close-packed feathers. And the more I sit with her, the more I marvel at how reptilian she is, the lucency of her pale round eyes, the waxy yellow skin about her bakelite black beak, the way she snakes her small head from side to side to focus on distant objects. Half the time she seems as alien as a snake, a thing hammered of metal and scales and glass. But then I see ineffably bird-like things about her, familiar qualities that turn her into something lovable and close. She scratches her fluffy chin with one awkward taloned foot, sneezes when bits of errant down get up her nose. And when I look again, She seems neither bird nor reptile, but a creature shaped by a million years of evolution for a life she's not yet lived. Those long, barred tail feathers and short, broad wings are perfectly shaped for sharp turns and brutal acceleration through a world of woodland obstacles. The patterns on her plumage will hide her in perfect, camouflaging drifts of light and shade. The tiny, hair-like feathers between her beak and eye, crines, are for catching blood, so that it will dry and flake and fall away, and the frowning eyebrows that lend her face its hollow, rapacious intensity are bony projections to protect her eyes when crashing into undergrowth after prey. Everything about the hawk is tuned and turned to hunt and kill. Yesterday, I discovered that when I suck air through my teeth and make a squeaking noise like an injured rabbit, all the tendons in her toes instantaneously contract, driving her talons into the glove with terrible, crushing force. This killing grip is an old, deep pattern in her brain, an innate response that hasn't yet found the stimulus meant to release it, because other sounds provoke it. Door hinges, squealing brakes, bicycles with unoiled wheels, and on the second afternoon, Joan Sutherland singing an aria on the radio. Ow! I laughed out loud at that. Stimulus, opera. A response, kill. But later these misapplied instincts stop being funny. At just past 6 o'clock, a small, unhappy wail came from a pram outside the window. Straight away the hawk drove her talons into my glove, ratcheting up the pressure in savage, stabbing spasms. Kill, the baby cries. Kill, kill, kill. 2 days pass. I sit and walk and sit and sleep, the hawk almost constantly on my fist. My arm aches and a damp tiredness grips my heart. A farming program on the radio. Wheat, forage, rapeseed, polytunnels and cherries. The hawk is alternately a hunchback toad, a nervous child, or a dragon. The house is a tip. Scraps of raw meat decorate the bin. I've run out of coffee. I have forgotten how to speak. My mouth makes small, mumbled assurances to the hawk that all is well. She meets them with silence, with thready, nervous cheeps through her nose. As I walk, she follows my feet with her eyes as if they were two small animals moving about the house with us. She's interested in flies, in specks of floating dust, in the way light falls on certain surfaces. What is she looking at? What is she thinking? I hear the click of the nictitating membrane that crosses her eyes as she blinks, and now I see them closely, her eyes begin to disturb me. They look like discs of pale paper stuck to the side of her head, each with a hole-punched black pupil housed under a transparent dome like a bubble of water. The hawk is stranger than I'd thought, and calmer than I believed possible. I'm starting to worry. Is there something wrong with her? She's oddly tame. Where is the lunatic I'd expected? For 2 days I've sat with her, and not once, contra White, have I longed to dismember her and batter her to death. I'd expected a barreling tornado of terror and wildness, some great and awful struggle of souls, but instead, as the light deepens and the late swifts outside ascend on flickering wings to bury themselves in the sky, I sit on a sofa watching a tired hawk go to sleep. The leading edges of her wings drop and rest against the glove. One downy grey eyelid slides up to cover an eye, then the other. Her shoulders fall, her head wobbles. The tip of her glossy black beak sinks into the feathers over her crop. Watching her doze in this vesper hour, my eyes close too, but when sleep comes, I'm standing in the skeleton of a burned-out house, in white, blank air that glitters faintly with mica or frost. Around me are blackened joists and rafters. I put out a hand, touch a piece of charred wood, cold, furred. Wrong. Rising panic, refusal, a sense of absolute dismay, then of toppling, the house collapsing into itself and on top of me, and we wake together, the hawk and I, her with a start of apprehension, a tightening of feet and feathers, and me with a slow, sickening disorientation that makes me fasten desperately onto the sight of the hawk, to drag me back into a world with no ash in it. The same thoughts over and over. Why is she sleeping so much? Hawks sleep when they're sick. She must be sick. Why am I sleeping? Am I sick too? What's wrong with her? What is wrong with us? Nothing was wrong with the hawk. She wasn't sick. She was a baby. She fell asleep because that's what babies do. I wasn't sick either, but I was orphaned and desperately suggestible, and I didn't know what was happening to me. For years I'd scoffed at White's notion of hawk training as a rite of passage. Overblown, I'd thought. Loopy. Because it wasn't like that. I knew it wasn't. I'd flown scores of hawks, and every step of their training was familiar to me. But while the steps were familiar, the person taking them was not. I was in ruins. Some deep part of me was trying to rebuild itself, and its model was right there on my fist. The hawk was everything I wanted to be. Solitary, self-possessed, free from grief and numb to the hurts of human life. I was turning into a hawk. I didn't shrink and grow plumes like the wart in The Sword in the Stone, who was transformed by Merlin into a Merlin as part of his magical education. I had loved that scene as a child. I had read it over and over again, thrilling at the wart's toes turning to talons and scratching on the floor, his primary feathers bursting in soft blue quills from the end of his fingers. But I was turning into a hawk all the same. The change came about through my grief, my watching, my not being myself. The first few days with a wild new hawk are a delicate, reflexive dance of manners. To judge when to scratch your nose without offence, when to walk and when to sit, when to retreat and when to come close, you must read your hawk's state of mind. You do this by watching her posture and her feathers, the workings of which turn the bird's shape into an exquisitely controlled barometer of mood. A hawk's simpler emotions are easily perceived. Feathers held tight to the body mean, I am afraid. Held loosely, they mean, I am at ease. But the longer you watch a hawk, the more subtleties you see, and soon, in my hypervigilant state, I was responding to the tiniest of cues. A frowning contraction of the crines around her beak and an almost imperceptible narrowing of her eyes meant something like happy. A particular fugitive expression on her face, oddly distant and reserved, meant sleepy. To train a hawk, you must watch it like a hawk, and so you come to understand its moods. Then you gain the ability to predict what it will do next. This is the sixth sense of the practiced animal trainer. Eventually, you don't see the hawk's body language at all. You seem to feel what it feels, notice what it notices. The hawk's apprehension becomes your own. You are exercising what the poet Keats called your chameleon quality. The ability to tolerate a loss of self and a loss of rationality by trusting the capacity to recreate oneself in another character or another environment. Such a feat of imaginative recreation has always come easily to me. Too easily. It's part of being a watcher, forgetting who you are and putting yourself in the thing you are watching. That is why the girl who was me when I was small loved watching birds. She made herself disappear and then, in the birds she watched, took flight. It was happening now. I had put myself in the hawk's wild mind to tame her, and as the days passed in the darkened room, my humanity was burning away. Three tentative raps on the front door. Hang on, I call. A small voice inside me, resentful and savage, hisses, Go away. It is Christina with two takeaway coffees and the Sunday papers. So, she says, settling herself in a chair by the fireplace, how's it going? Is the hawk okay? I nod. I raise my eyebrows. I am vaguely aware this isn't enough to make a conversation. I say. The voice is not entirely mine. She hugs her knees and looks at me curiously. I must try harder, I think. So I talk about the hawk for a while, and then I can't speak any more. I stare at my paper cup. I am pleased to see her. She shouldn't be here. This coffee is good. We should be alone. These resentful thoughts surprise me. Manning the hawk is all about showing it new things. Christina is a new thing. I'm going to try something, I tell her. Ignore the hawk. Just keep reading the papers. I fetch a fresh piece of beef from the kitchen, sit with the hawk on the sofa, reach up and remove her hood. There's a moment of fast-beating incomprehension and the air in the room turns to ice. Tight-feathered, in savage resolution, eyes like porcelain saucers, the hawk stares. My heart sinks. She's going to bait. But the moment stretches, and she does not. After a deal of cautious observation, she decides that a human turning newspaper pages is something entirely fascinating. An hour later, all is calm and companionable. We're watching television. The hawk balances evenly on the balls of her feet, mesmerized by the flickering screen. Tiny white wisps of down still attached to the finials of her scapular feathers wave in the draught from the hall. Then, without warning, she bursts from my fist in a whirlwind of a bait. Papers fly. Christina flinches. Shit, I think. I should hood her. Let her rest. This is too much. But I'm wrong. Fear did not engender this bait. Frustration did. She picks at her dresses in displaced fury, then tears at the meat beneath her toes. She's hungry. The food is a wonderful discovery. She is a delicate, decisive gastronome. She picks and bites and swallows and squeaks in happiness and bites and swallows again. I am thrilled, but also indignant. This moment was to have been born of solitude and meditative darkness. Not this. Not daylight with another person in the room and hello, hello on the television. Not in the presence of comedy Nazis in a soundtrack about giant sausages and the occupation of France. She narrows her eyes with pleasure, bristles around the nose, and her feathers soften into loose falls of ochre and cream. "Has she done that before?" asks Christina. "No," I say. "This is the first time." Laughter from the television audience as an SS officer dresses a woman hoves into view, and the hawk finishes eating, lifts herself into a vast, frothy mop of feathers, holds them there for an instant, and shakes them all back into place. A rouse. It is a sign of contentment, and she has not roused before. Now my hawk is tame enough to sit bareheaded. From her perch by the window, she watches the curtains move over a carpet furred with dust. She won't yet be picked up without a bait, but I'm working on that. From the sofa, I flick a thumbnail-sized scrap of steak towards her. It falls with a sticky thwick on the vinyl cloth beneath her perch. She looks down at it, frowns, turns her head to one side to inspect it more carefully, then hops down with a scratch of talons and a rattle of feathers, picks the meat delicately from the floor, and swallows it. Gone. For a while she stands there as if trying to remember something she has forgotten, then bounces back onto the perch with brio, all shaggy trousers and waggy tail. I wait a while and send another scrap of flesh her way. Thwick. Hop. Swallow. Hop. I lower myself to the floor and sit there for a while. Shuffling slowly sideways on my rump, I watch the hawk out of the corner of my eye. She tenses. I stop. She untenses. I move. She tenses. I stop again. I inch across the carpet until I reach that hair-fine juncture where any movement nearer will make her bait from the perch. Breathing as carefully as if I were about to take an extravagantly long rifle shot, I slowly, so slowly, extend my garnished fist towards her. I can almost taste the hawk's indecision. The air is thick with it. But joy, she is looking at the food in front of her. She leans forward, as if to pick it from the glove, but then something inside her snaps. With an awful clang of the metal ring of the perch against its steel base, she baits away from me. Damn. I take her up onto the glove for a few mouthfuls of food. When she is settled back on the perch, we play the game again. Flick, hop, flick. She's solved the puzzle of where the food is coming from, and some part of her is reconsidering my place in her world. She watches me intently as I inch towards her and again extend the garnished glove. She leans across and snaps up my gift of steak. My heart leaps. She takes another piece, and then another, smacking her glossy black chops. As I sit there, happily feeding titbits to the hawk, her name drops into my head. Mabel. From Amabilis, meaning lovable or dear. An old, slightly silly name. An unfashionable name. There is something of the grandmother about it, antimacassars and afternoon teas. There's a superstition among falconers that a hawk's ability is inversely proportional to the ferocity of its name. Call a hawk Tiddles, and it will be a formidable hunter. Call it Spitfire or Slayer, and it will probably refuse to fly at all. White called his hawk Goss for short, but also awarded him a host of darkly grandiose other names that for years made me roll my eyes in exasperation. Hamlet, Macbeth, Strindberg, Van Gogh, Astor, Baal, Medici, Roderick Dhu, Lord George Gordon, Byron, Odin, Nero, Death, Tarquin, Edgar Allan Poe. Imagine, I used to think, amused and faintly contemptuous. Imagine calling your goshawk any of those things. But now that list just made me sad. My hawk needed a name as far from that awful litany, as far from death as it could get. Mabel. I say the word out loud to her and watch her watching me say it. My mouth shapes the word. Mabel. And as I say it, it strikes me that all those people outside the window who shop and walk and cycle and go home and eat and love and sleep and dream, all of them have names. And so do I. Helen, I say. How strange it sounds. How very strange. I put another piece of meat on my glove, and the hawk leans down and eats. Chapter 10. Darkness. He pours another whiskey into his emptied glass and broods over the day's events. He is free, but he has shackled himself to a madman, a lunatic. At the very least, a sufferer of intermittent delusional insanity, he turns down the beam of the paraffin lamp and sinks back into the chair, gloomily rereading the report he has written on the progress of his goshawk's education. 6:15 to 6:45, walked round and round Goss, holding out a leg, while he baited whenever I came too close, came away without feeding him. This is not in the book. I have done the same thing with the same results for 50 minutes in every hour since, until 6 o'clock at night. He despised that rabbit leg. He despised the fur on it, the claws, the crown of pale flesh that grew dry and waxen as the hours passed. He despised it because the hawk did not want it. The hawk did not want him either. He had whistled to the hawk all day, and his lips had grown dry as the whistle gave out, and his solicitude had thinned to frustration and finally despair. Last night the frustration had reached such a pitch that he prevented Goss from regaining the fist after a bait. Worse, gloried in the hawk hanging there, revolving slowly on his jesses. It was a terrible sin. He is full of shame. And worry. Goss's mutes are green. Does that mean his hawk is sick? Maybe that is why he did not want the rabbit. What should he do? Starvation, he thinks. That will cure the stomach upset, if it is one. Perhaps he shall give the hawk some egg tomorrow? But the most important thing of all is this. He shall eat when he jumps for it, not before. White's plan would have worked had he stuck to it, but he did not. By dawn, Goss had been given the greater part of rabbit to eat, and he had not jumped to the fist. Another resolution was broken. They all were. Even White's plan to keep the hawk awake for 3 days and nights had failed. He'd felt so sorry for Goss, he kept returning him to his perch for short bouts of sleep. Freed from White's presence, Goss remembered how much better life was when not tied to a human who kept stroking it and talking to it and bothering it with slippery rabbit livers and singing and whistling and moving glasses of liquid up and down. When he came to pick it up again, the hawk was always as wild as ever. Poor Goss. Poor, ragged, fearful, broken-feathered Goss. I thought of him often as I sat with my hawk. I saw him in black and white and a long way off, as if viewed through the wrong end of a telescope, a miniature, miserable hawk baiting and twittering in distress on the grey lawns of a distant house. Goss was very real to me. But White was not. It was hard to imagine him with his hawk. Sitting with my own, it was hard to imagine him at all. I looked at photographs, but they were all of different people. One was a pale-eyed man with a Shakespearean beard who'd written books under the pen name James Aston, and another a thin young man with nervous eyes and a spare, haunted face who was Mr. White the schoolmaster. There were photographs of White the countryman, in an open-necked shirt and a tweed jacket, looking louche and amused, and photographs of White much later in his life, a corpulent, white-bearded English Hemingway, a woolly-sweated Falstaff. I couldn't reconcile these faces. I read The Goshawk again as I sat with Mabel, read it many times, and every time it seemed a different book. Sometimes a caustically funny romance, sometimes the journal of a man laughing at failure, sometimes a heartbreaking tract of another man's despair. But one White was clear to me as I manned my hawk. It was not White the falconer. It was the man who had, for the first time in his life, discovered the joys of domesticity. The man who painted woodwork the brightest of blues and reds, who arranged feathers in jars on his mantelpiece and made curries from prawns and eggs and spoons of thin-cut marmalade. I saw him boiling his laundry in the copper on the kitchen stove and sitting in his armchair reading Masefield's Midnight Folk, with his setter Brownie sleeping at his feet. And I saw him drinking. There was always a bottle at White's side, and his battle with Goss made him drink all the more. "It was not that one drank enough to become incapable or stupid," he wrote, "but alcohol now seemed the only way of continuing to live." As I sat with my hawk and puzzled over White, I wondered if it was alcohol that obscured him, blurred him from view. I knew the notion was fanciful, but even so there seemed some deep connection between White's drinking and his evasiveness. And I was sure that it was the drink that irrigated White's constant self-sabotage. For it is a common trait of alcoholics to make plans and promises to oneself, to others, fervently, sincerely, and in hope of redemption. Promises that are broken again and again through fear, through loss of nerve, through any number of things that hide that deep desire at heart to obliterate one's broken self. I opened the curtains the next morning. The brightness of the room made me clearer, which concerned her for a while, but when a broad stripe of sunlight fell across her back, she raised her feathers to greet it. Now, standing in a shallow bath next to her perch, she nibbles her toes, takes precise and tiny bites of water. She jumps back onto her perch and begins to preen herself, contorting her body into the stylized shapes of Japanese paintings of courtly goshawks. She runs her beak through one feather after another in quick succession. The sound is of paper being scored or a pack of cards being shuffled. Then she stretches one broad wing behind her, drags it slowly back over her sunlit tail, and rouses, squeaking happily through her nose. I watch all this with a ravenous, gulping down champagne sense of joy. "Look how happy she is," I think. This room is not a dungeon, and I am not a torturer. I am a beneficent figure, one who crouches and stoops in anxious genuflection, bearing delicious treats of steak in my hand. It is hubris. Less than an hour later, I am certain that my hawk hates me, and I am the worst falconer in the history of the world. No matter that Mabel is far tamer than any of the boys or books had told me she would be. I've comprehensively failed her. The hawk is ruined. I know this is true because she doesn't want to be hooded. Until now, she has accepted the hood with equanimity. Earlier today, I sensed a little thrum of disquiet in her heart, and now it has exploded into outright rebellion. I bring the hood up to her head, and she dodges it, snakes her head, contracts it into her neck, ducks and runs. I know why this is happening. To begin with, the hood was a welcome refuge, but now she's decided I'm harmless. It is merely something that stops her seeing, and she wants to see. Now, unhappy, unsettled, lifting one foot then the other, the hawk looks about the room for somewhere to go. Her mood is contagious. My heart flutters tightly, heavily in my chest. I have lost the ability to disappear. I try to remove myself by listening to the cricket on the radio, but can't understand what the commentator is saying. I can only turn my attention from my unhappy hawk by thinking about the hood I'm holding. It is all she is thinking of, too. I remember hauling this hood out of my bag while looking for a pen before a university seminar a few months ago. "What's that?" asked a colleague. "A falcon hood," I said, not looking up. "Have you brought it in to show it to people?" "No, it was just in my bag." "But can I look at it?" "Absolutely, go ahead." She picked it up, fascinated. "What an amazing thing," she said, frowning under her straight-cut fringe. "It goes over the hawk's head to keep it quiet, right?" And she looked inside where the moulded leather was stitched with lines of hair-fine thread and then turned it over in her hands, examining the bevelled opening for the hawk's beak and the plaited Turk's head knot you hold it by and the two long braces at the back that pull the hood open and closed. She set it back on the table reverently. "It's so beautifully made," she said. "It's like a Prada shoe." "Indeed, this hood is among the best of its kind. It was made by an American falconer called Doug Pinio, and it weighs almost nothing. A few grams, that is all. Something about its perfect lightness, set against the heaviness of my heart, makes me giddy. I shut my eyes and my head is full of hoods, modern American hoods like this one. Loose-braced Bahraini hoods of soft goatskin for passage sakers and peregrines, Syrian hoods, Turkmen hoods, Afghan hoods, tiny Indian hoods in snakeskin for shikras and sparrowhawks, huge eagle hoods from Central Asia, 16th-century French hoods cut from white kidskin, embroidered with golden thread and painted with coats of arms. They're not a European invention. Frankish knights learned how to use hoods from Arab falconers during the Crusades, and a shared love of falconry made hawks political pawns in those wars. When a white gerfalcon owned by King Philip I of Spain broke its leash during the siege of Acre and flew up to the city walls, the king sent an envoy into the city to request its return. Saladin refused. And Philip sent another envoy, accompanied by trumpets, ensigns and heralds, offering 1,000 gold crowns for the falcon. Was it returned? I can't recall. Did it matter? No, I think savagely. They're all dead. Long dead. I think of Saladin taking the king's falcon onto his own hand and covering its eyes with leather. I own this. It is mine. I think of fetish hoods. I think of distant wars. I think of Abu Ghraib, sand in the mouth, coercion, history and hawks and hoods and the implications of taking something sight away to calm it. It's in your own best interest. Rising nausea. There's a sensation of ground being lost, of wet sand washing from under my feet. I don't want to think of the photographs of the tortured man with the hood on his head and the wires to his hands and the invisible enemy who holds the camera, but it is all I can see, and the word hood like a hot stone in my mouth. Burqa, the word in Arabic. Hood. I start speaking to the hawk, I think to the hawk, in a voice as low and reassuring as I can make it. When you travel in the car, Mabel, I say, there'll be lots of frightening things out there, and we can't have you crashing about while I drive. It's just to keep you feeling safe. And then, it is necessary. I hear myself say it. It is necessary. That is what I am telling myself, but I don't like it. Nor does she. Patiently, I offer it again. Look, I say carefully, just a hood. I move it slowly up to her feathered chin. She baits. I wait until she settles and move it up to her chin again. Bait, and again. Bait, bait, bait. I want to be gentle. I am being gentle, but my gentleness is a veneer on raging despair. I don't want to hood her. She knows it. On the radio, the cricket commentator explains in gleeful detail why a batsman's defensive stroke has failed. Shut up, Aggers, I snap, and try once again. Come on, Mabel, I say beseechingly, and in another minute, the hood is on, she is back on her perch, and I am slumped on the sofa. The world is burning, and I don't want to touch it. This is a disaster. A disaster. I can't do this. Not any of it. I am a terrible falconer. I burst into tears. The hawk dissolves. I curl up, bury my face in a cushion, and cry myself to sleep. 40 minutes later, Stuart is assessing the hawk with narrowed, practiced eyes. Small, isn't she? He says, dragging 4 fingers thoughtfully down one stubbled cheek. But she's a good-looking goss. Long body, long tail. Bird hawk. By this he means my goshawk might be better suited to fly at pheasants and partridges than rabbits or hares. Yes. How are you doing with her? Asks Mandy. She's sitting on my sofa rolling a cigarette, looking amazing, like a rural punk princess from an unlikely Thomas Hardy novel. I tell her that the hawk is surprisingly tame and everything's going well. But it is a dreadful lie. When they'd knocked on the door and roused me from sleep, I knew I had to maintain some desperate fiction of competence. And so far, I'd managed this. There had been a nasty moment when Mandy looked at me with concern in her eyes and I realized my own were red and raw. It's okay, I told myself. She'll think I've been crying about Dad. I pick up the hawk and stand there like someone with a present at a party and no clear idea to whom I should hand it. Lie down, Jess, says Stuart. The black and white English pointer they've brought flops onto the rug and lets out a sigh. I unhood Mabel. She stands on tiptoe, the tip of her beak pressed to her spangled and silvery chest, looking down at this new phenomenon that is a dog. The dog looks at her. So do we. There is a curious silence. I mistake it for anger, for disappointment, for anything but what it is. Astonishment. A look of wonder passes over Stuart's face. Well, he says eventually, you've got gold there. I thought she'd freak out completely. She's very well manned. Really? She's so calm, Helen, says Mandy. It takes me a while to even half believe them, but it helps that I managed to hood Mabel without too much fuss, and after 2 cups of tea and an hour in their company, the world is bright again. Don't drag your feet, Stuart says as they leave. Get her out the house. Take her outside. Manor in the streets. I know he's right. It's time for the next stage of training. Carriage is what falconers call walking with a hawk to tame it, and all my books insisted it was the key to a well-trained goss. The key to her management is to carry, 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 wrote Gilbert Blane. It was the grand secret of discipline to Edward Mitchell. Back in the 17th century, Edward Burt had explained that when you walk with a hawk, her eye doth still behold change of objects, which is why carriage works, and why you can't tame a hawk by keeping her indoors. Such a hawk will endure nothing, because she hath not been made acquainted with anything, he says. Oh, Edmund Burt, I think. I wish it was still the 17th century. There'd have been fewer things out there to frighten my hawk. But I knew that wasn't true. There'd have been carts and horses and crowds and dogs, and they'd have been just as frightening for a half-manned goshawk as buses and mopeds and students on bikes. The difference was that in 1615, no one would have paid me the slightest attention. Hawks on the streets of Cambridge would have been as unremarkable a sight as dogs on Leeds today. Walking with my hawk will be an open invitation for everyone to come up and stare and inquire and quiz me about the hawk and what she is and who I am and why. And beneath my disinclination to engage in conversation, there is a much simpler terror. People. Just people. I don't want to see people at all. After the door is closed, I look at it for a long while, rubbing my cheek where the cushion had left a deep indented scar. Later that afternoon, I take Mabel into the walled garden of my college house. Above us is a deep field of fast-moving cumulus. Branches lift in the breeze, leaves shift with a collapsing, papery flicker. The air is thick with sun and dust and dandelion seeds. There's too much light. Too much contrast, too much noise and movement. I flinch at the hurry of it all. But the hawk is unperturbed. She tips her head sideways to look up at the moving clouds. In daylight, her irises are flat and shiny and slightly blurred, with pupils that dilate and contract like a camera lens. She focuses, zip, 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 up to track a passing Cessna, and then she turns her head upside down to watch a fly, and then tracks another fly, and pulls abstractedly at the meat I hold in the glove, and watches other things, way, way beyond my poor human vision. The world she lives in is not mine. Life is faster for her, time runs slower. Her eyes can follow the wing beats of a bee as easily as ours follow the wing beats of a bird. What is she seeing, I wonder? And my brain does backflips trying to imagine it, because I can't. I have three different receptor sensitivities in my eyes, red, green, and blue. Hawks, like other birds, have four. This hawk can see colours I cannot, right into the ultraviolet spectrum. She can see polarised light, too, watch thermals of warm air rise, roil, and spill into clouds, and trace, too, the magnetic lines of force that stretch across the earth. The light falling into her deep black pupils is registered with such frightening precision that she can see with fierce clarity things I can't possibly resolve from the generalized blur. The claws on the toes of the house martins overhead. The veins on the wings of the white butterfly hunting its wavering course over the mustards at the end of the garden. I'm standing there, my sorry human eyes overwhelmed by light and detail, while the hawk watches everything with the greedy intensity of a child filling in a colouring book, scribbling joyously, blocking in colour, making the pages its own. And all I can think is, I want to go back inside. Chapter 11. Leaving Home. Keys in pocket, hawk on fist, and off we go. Leaving the house that evening is frightening. Somewhere in my mind, ropes uncoil and fall. It feels like an unmooring, as if I were an airship ascending on its maiden flight into darkness. Stepping over the low railings into the park, I head for the thick black avenue of limes and the lamplit leaves beneath. Everything seems hot and clean and dangerous, and my senses are screwed to their utmost as if someone had told me the park was full of hungry lions. Night air moves in the spaces between the trees. Moths make dusty circles about the lamps. I look down and see each pale blade of grass casts two separate shadows from the two nearest lamps, and so do I, and in the distance comes the collapsing echo of a moving train, and somewhere closer a dog barks twice, and there's broken glass by the path, and next to it a feather from the breast of a wood pigeon, judging by its size and curl. It lies upon the grass, as if held just above it, gleaming softly in the darkness. "Bloody hell, Mabel," I whisper. "Who spiked my tea with acid?" Night has never looked like this before. I walk deeper into this lamplit world, wondering at my heightened perception and reassured by how unconcerned the hawk is. She does not look up. She couldn't care less about her surroundings. She's hunched busily over the rabbit leg in my glove. It is a tiring, a piece of sinewy, bony meat to keep her occupied as we walk, drawing her attention from the things around her. She pulls and picks scraps from it with the rapt concentration of a diner disassembling a lobster. Watching her, I begin to relax, and straight away the emptied world is full of people. But they are not people. They are things to shun, to fear, to turn from, shielding my hawk. They come towards us like tumbling rocks in a video game, threatening destruction with the merest glancing blow. My heart beats fast. Escape and evasion. I am here to show the hawk people, but from a safe distance merely, and those three men in pastel shirts are heading right towards us. I dodge behind a tree trunk and let them pass. As their backs enter Mabel's line of sight, she sucks her feathers in so tightly she seems vacuum-packed in plastic. When they're gone, she shakes her head nervously, cheeps once through her nose, and starts eating again. A minute later, a woman swinging supermarket bags is upon us, and there's nowhere to go. Where did all these bloody people come from? I look about in desperation. Mabel is now a pair of huge and haunted eyes, a ghost of bones and sinews, seconds from her bait. I hold her close to my chest and turn in a slow circle to block the woman from view. The woman doesn't see the hawk. What she sees is a weirdo in a tattered jacket and baggy corduroy trousers revolving on the spot for no good reason. She hurries past, fast. There's a sense of dreadful escalation. It's fine, I tell myself. This is going well, but blood sings loud in my ears. A bicycle hisses by. The hawk baits. I curse. Another bicycle. She baits. Again. My nerve breaks. I start back to the house. We are nearly at the door when a runner passes. He's come up silently behind us on his expensive trainers. And the hawk baits once again. I hate him for upsetting my hawk. Actually hate him. I'm outraged by his existence. All the anger within me, the anger I didn't know was there, the anger the books call one of the five stages of grief, rears up in a towering instant of white-hot fury. I look at his retreating back and wish him death. But then he breaks stride, turns back and stops 10 feet from us. Sorry, I say, smiling and biting back ire. It's her first time out of the house, and she's still scared of people. God, no, I'm sorry, he says. I didn't see her. He's a person, I realize. A real person. Skinny and bearded and wearing a blue T-shirt and with a water bottle in his hand, and he is friendly and wary and a little in awe of the hawk. I think he might be a nice man. I hope I didn't startle you, I begin apologetically. He grins and shakes his head. I was surprised. It's not something you see every day. I turn briefly to the hawk as she bends down to pull at the rabbit leg again. I open my mouth to speak, but when I look up, he has gone. It is bright after heavy rain and the crowds of closing time have gone. On this second expedition from the house, Mabel grips the glove more tightly than ever. She is tense. She looks smaller and feels heavier in this mood, as if fear had a weight to it, as if pewter had been poured into her long and airy bones. The raindrop marks on her tight feathered front run together into long lines like those around a downturned mouth. She picks fitfully at the food, but mostly she stares, taut with reserve, about her. She follows bicycles with her eyes. She hunches, ready to spring when people come too close. Children alarm her. She's unsure about dogs. Big dogs, that is. Small dogs fascinate her for other reasons. After 10 minutes of haunted apprehension, the goshawk decides that she's not going to be eaten or beaten to death by any of these things. She rouses and begins to eat. Cars and buses rattle fumily past, and when the food is gone, she stands staring at the strange world around her. So do I. I've been with the hawk so long, just her and me, that I'm seeing my city through her eyes. She watches a woman throwing a ball to her dog on the grass, and I watch too, as baffled by what she's doing as the hawk is. I stare at traffic lights before I remember what they are. Bicycles are spinning mysteries of glittering metal. The buses going past are walls with wheels. What's salient to the hawk in the city is not what is salient to man. The things she sees are uninteresting to her, irrelevant, until there's a clatter of wings. We both look up. There's a pigeon, a wood pigeon, sailing down to roost in a lime tree above us. Time slows, the air thickens, and the hawk is transformed. It's as if all her weapon systems were suddenly engaged. Red crosshairs. She stands on her toes and cranes her neck. This flight path, this thing, she thinks. This is fascinating. Some part of the hawk's young brain has just worked something out, and it has everything to do with death.
For the goshawk, wrote White, the necessity was a long walk on the fist, as it always was. But he walked as if the walking itself were the secret, not his attention to the feelings of his hawk. Even in the aftermath of my father's death, my tattered heart knew that the secret to taming hawks was to take things slowly. To move from darkness to light, from enclosed rooms into the open air. To stand at a distance first, and then grow closer over many days to this alien world of raucous voices and swinging arms, of bright plastic buggies and roaring mopeds. Day by day, foot by foot, mouthful by mouthful, my hawk would come to see that these things were not a threat, and would look upon them with equanimity. But it was continuous murder for Goss. White walked because that was what the books said he should do, and so that was what he did, taking Goss outside even on the day he arrived. 48 hours later he was walked to the Wheeler's farmhouse to meet all the family, barking dogs and all, and the next day they were out on the road meeting cars and cyclists. He baits repeatedly on these trips, White noted in his day book. On it went. He took Goss with him to the pub, took him fishing for carp, took him to Banbury in a motor car. He had to learn to stand that bustle, wrote White, as we all have to do, however little we visited. And he did, just as a despairing soul will finally comprehend its helplessness in the face of continuing horror and bear it because there is no alternative, so with Goss. He had no alternative. There was no softness in his taming. He had to learn to bear things through being frightened all the time, just as White had learned there was no escape in his own education. Down the small roads and grassy rides and across fields damp with standing hay, White walked himself into the landscape. Whole days went past on foot, the novice Ostringer sinking gratefully into the rhythm and weather of the land. Walking home in the evening along the high-hedged Buckinghamshire lanes, he watched the red moon perceptibly rising, which he had seen to sink as a yellow one at dawn. At night, the world became magical by virtue of its emptiness, and the ridings a place of mists and stars and solitude. This was his patient excursion into the fields and back into the past. Despite the eccentricity of a hawk on his fist, What White was doing was very much of his time. Long walks in the English countryside, often at night, were astonishingly popular in the 1930s. Rambling clubs published calendars of full moons. Train companies laid on mystery trains to rural destinations. And when in 1932,